I hope that the Biden administration will provide unified communications that apply to all public health so that not every single public health department in the nation, because there are several thousand of them, is crafting their own policy for that.
It's kind of what we're seeing right now.
Yes.
Hello and welcome to HIMSCast. I'm your host, Jonah Comstock. We are joined today by Sebastian Sager, CEO of Emoca. Sebastian is going to speak to us a little bit about what we can expect in 2021 in the world of telehealth and telehealth legislation and regulation under the Biden administration. And we may chat a little bit also about his company and what they're up to this year. I'm joined also by Kat Jersich, Senior Editor at Healthcare IT News. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having me, Jonah and Kat.
Thanks so much.
Before we jump in, I do want to thank our sponsor for this episode, Kajit. Kajit provides managed IoT connectivity to deliver safe, reliable, and controlled internet connectivity to healthcare professionals, enterprises, state and local governments, including education and IoT solution providers. Kajit offers hybrid and multi-network access across all major global wireless networks and is committed to working closely with you to make your IoT solutions a reality. To learn more, visit get.kajit.net/healthIoT. Kat, why don't you set us up and kick us off with the first question for Sebastian.
Sure. Well, it's a little bit of a softball, but I am interested from your perspective. We've seen enormous changes in the telehealth landscape over the last year. Obviously, it's become something of almost a cliche to say that COVID-19 changed the telehealth landscape, probably permanently. And just from your perspective, what changes have you seen, both from a provider, from the providers you work with, and maybe from patients too, in terms of virtual care over the last year?
Yes. Well, in a lot of ways, it feels like it's a dramatic change because the idea that you could have a virtual live visit was not a standard offering for most health plans or most providers, and it became a relatively standard offering. So that mind shift to assuming that telehealth is available was a big change. And of course, it felt more radical early on in the pandemic than it does right now. But that also has not changed the fact that certain people who don't access healthcare as often as others also did not happen to access live stream telehealth. So, the most vulnerable populations or the populations that have the most complex chronic diseases are not necessarily having live stream video appointments with their provider. And they may not have been visiting their provider as often as they should have beforehand either.
Interesting. You're touching on something that I am really passionate about, which is the digital divide in healthcare and how we're seeing it continue to endure, even despite this expansion in telehealth technology. So thinking ahead a little bit, what are some moves that the next Congress and the next presidential administration can make in order to safeguard healthcare and promote equity and access, especially for folks who may not have broadband access or who may not have the technological literacy to feel comfortable with one-on-one synchronous video interaction?
Yeah, so I think that the structure of the way healthcare is delivered right now is a real, let's say, you could call it a disadvantage or maybe a misappropriation of resources for people with severe chronic disease issues that have to be managed. So you're just not going to manage chronic disease with an appointment every 6 months or every 3 months even. It's just not going to happen, whether that's virtual or whether that's in person. So what that means is that modalities have to emerge for helping patients in other ways in between those visits. The most effective way to do that is going to be asynchronous. So that means frequent touch points with the patient to help them do those things on a daily basis that help them manage their disease and eventually form habits that will allow them to self-manage over time.
Do you mind if I jump in, Kat?
Go ahead, Jonah.
Do you think there's almost been kind of damage done this year in that telehealth has become so mainstream. People have been so comfortable with it. But also, it sort of propagated this idea that telehealth is video visits, and it is just a video version of the in-person video. And so this idea of asynchronous telehealth might have a harder road to get up now that now that people have sort of been comfortable with this other version of telehealth.
Well, maybe from the regulatory perspective, yes, all the attention's really on live stream. But once you start using something, and that's the first step, you just realize how inefficient it is and how, or what the small failures are. So for example, I heard somebody yesterday comparing the video quality on, let's say Zoom versus a Google. And, did we really care that much before the pandemic? So you start to get into these smaller details, which really matter. And I'll tell you one thing that's really hard on all these, when you deal with patients, is getting an appointment. So you still have the same, even though it's a video connection, it's hard to form an appointment and then get both parties to show up at the exact same time. So I think that the first step in moving towards asynchronous virtual care is usage of live video to the point where the entrepreneurs and the innovators and the regulators start to understand, hey, you know what? We want to fix these problems we have with live interaction.
So speaking of regulators, I'm wondering what actions you think members of the federal government and even state governments can take both to address that need to make video visits more accessible for patients, but also to consider those other kinds of tools, those asynchronous tools, for example, remote patient monitoring tools or chatbots. What are some ways that those can be kind of enshrined in regulation so that they continue to be accessible for people both during the pandemic and after, maybe, hopefully?
Right. Yeah. So it's a complicated and multifaceted question, and there are a lot of answers, and there's some really, really bright people out there trying to figure it out. But there are a few things that I see are seem to be obvious. So on the one hand, Medicaid plans throughout the country have different policies on all this, and it's very confusing. And of course, now that you can do care virtually, you could offer healthcare workers in Cleveland helping patients on Medicaid in California, but you couldn't really understand all the regulations that are in California for Medicaid. And I talk about Medicaid because this is the most vulnerable populations besides the uninsured. So on the one hand, I think harmonizing Medicaid policy would be wonderful, although it is a state issue. At the national level, we have a confusing dynamic. So, everybody will push for CMS to open up remote patient monitoring, but that push is reimbursement codes. And reimbursement is the way of the past, really, right? Because aren't we trying to move to a value-based system where we put the onus of outcomes on the providers and the health plans? So while it's a great thing to see remote patient monitoring codes expanded, I personally, as an entrepreneur, don't really like the idea that what I'd be selling as a return on investment is a revenue model. I'd rather be selling an improvement in healthcare that all parties are participating in and financially incented to also deliver.
But you're not able to do that unless we kind of embrace value-based care and a more systemic level than we have so far.
Right. Well, I think my point was more that, yes, it's great to have remote patient monitoring expand as a reimbursement model, because fact of the matter is providers are not going to be doing this in-between management without some compensation. That is clear and that is normal. So we have to have compensation mechanisms where the provider then has this flexibility to choose what tools are going to use to achieve that end goal, which should be that the patient is not, has reduced emergency room visits, reduced hospitalizations, and generally has the health outcomes that we're hoping for. So in terms of what I'm seeing a correct reaction by providers to a really hard business model. Being a provider is a hard business model. Being in primary care is tough. we do need value-based models if the patient's going to come first.
Yeah, I've heard folks express some discomfort with the idea of, if you send a text message, how do you file that for reimbursement, things like that, which could be useful and helpful for patients, especially with things like, I've been doing a lot of reporting on the COVID-19 vaccine, so forgive me here, but things like texting a patient and reminding them, hey, you have your second dose coming up. That's care provision, but it's not necessarily workable, at least in the long term, with our current reimbursement models. So that's definitely something I'm hearing a lot about too.
Right. But what a task for the actuaries over at CMS to decide what's the value of like one text message. And the same thing happened with remote patient monitoring. They decided that you needed 16 interactions in a month in order to bill a code. That makes sense. What do they want? They want that patients are actually using these technologies. But does 16 interactions mean that there's a health outcome? And the answer is, we don't know. So we will struggle in trying to apportion these dollars to specific acts, which are really just like, what is a text message? What's a live video visit? What's Emoca's asynchronous video visit? It's a means of communication. And what do we do with that? We're trying to improve the health outcome. So let's get the health outcome that we want as the goal and put some incentives on that.
Definitely. I'm thinking specifically a little bit more about the remote patient monitoring and getting those devices into the hands of patients. And we've seen a huge amount of money allocated from the FCC over the last year, and it's continuing into the next year, given the budget that was signed by Congress not too long ago. And what I've seen from providers and health systems is a lot of the time they use that money to purchase medical devices and get them into the hands of patients. Is that something that you anticipate continuing going forward, or is there any shift that you think will happen, again, given the uncertain future around video visits and around the pandemic?
Interesting. I think that the device is only good if you're using the data it's collecting, right? So it's a great boon for the medical device industry. I don't really know whether capturing someone's blood pressure, assuming that they even know how to use that machine, is helpful or not helpful if the data is not being managed on a near daily basis, so that you can catch the problems that are daily problems and react right away. So the data is only as good as the ability to intervene and fix the problem. So again, device, providing incentives to get devices into patients' hands. Interesting. The outcome will be determined when healthcare workers, providers, payers are focused on what you do with that data that specific day that it arrives.
Do you think that there's any potential there to use artificial intelligence and machine learning to try to note fluctuations in that data, so it doesn't necessarily have to be manual, for example, so you don't have to have a clinician on the other end trying to find a signal in the noise, and instead have a tool that automates perhaps an alert where if there's a fluctuation between a certain number or things like that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the ability to take in the clinical world, if you have a certain event and you know what the best practice is, well, that's already, if you're able to automate that, that's artificial intelligence in a very basic way. So a very simple algorithm. These are going to be extremely helpful, especially in triaging patients. Well, what do you have a cold now? Okay. Are you congested? You know, asking all these questions, this can be done in an automated way, but it's only going to really work if the data that you're capturing is not garbage. And when the data you're capturing is not clearly the real data that the patient, you know, that is their heart rate, it is their blood pressure, it is whether they're taking their medication or not. If you don't know that, you cannot apply artificial intelligence or machine learning successfully. And I think medication adherence is one of those things. The government, so the regulatory standard for adherence is actually not whether people take their medication and whether they've ingested it or inhaled it correctly, it's whether they possess it. So you're not able to apply any artificial intelligence to that except to predict whether people who might have it do well or not, which is just core in terms of like what we can expect from data in this day and age of increasing technology innovation.
We are going to get on with the second half of this podcast in just a moment. We're going to talk a little more about the new political environment side of things and how that's going to affect telehealth. But first, I just want to give one more shout out to our podcast sponsor today, Kajit. Whether to enable digital access that ensures patients have a reliable connection to telehealth providers or connect and control remote patient monitoring devices, Kajit provides a managed IoT platform that helps you launch a complex mobile solution. Again, you can learn more at get.kajit.net/health IoT. So thank you again to Kajit. So Sebastian, we really wanted to have you on the show to talk a little bit about how you see, well, I guess what the incoming administration can do for, first of all, in terms of things they might not need Congress for, like executive orders. And second of all, what might we expect to see now that we have a democratically controlled Congress coming up?
Yes, well, from the regulatory perspective and specifically for telehealth, the CMS administrator is going, you know, who that is and what their strategy will be is going to drive a lot of the regulatory change around telehealth or the policy. So we'll have to wait and see who that is. On the other hand, we do know what the previous administrator under Biden Obama, what Dr. Slavitt's priorities were. And we know what Dr. Seema Verma's priorities have been. There's a lot of alignment there. That's the good news, that over the last 10 years, there has been a lot of movement to advance telehealth and remote monitoring, and also to focus on chronic conditions and underserved populations. That effort has to continue. I assume that it really will, because we are moving forward with a lot of value-based care initiatives. So those have to continue, and hopefully they accelerate, because we're in a time where, you know, it's a really hard time with the pandemic in general. And it cannot be understated that a lot of people are unemployed. A lot of people have lost their insurance. A lot of people may have long lasting impacts from having had COVID-19, either on their heart, on their lungs. And so we will have to act very quickly. And we also have just a pitiful situation in terms of how a certain part of our population, you know, generally speaking poor, generally speaking minority, is accessing healthcare. We should not be letting that stand, because we're a modern economy, and you can see how fast we can mobilize trillions of dollars, right? This is just now the Biden plan announces close to $2 trillion in relief. Okay. Let's help populations so that we don't have these ridiculous disparities, which impact the entire economy.
Speaking of Biden's pandemic relief plan, which you just spoke about recently, and in addition to his rural health plan and some of his other initiatives that he's spoken about over the last few weeks, does anything stand out to you in terms of consequences that might be unexpected for telehealth, both positive and maybe negative ones, things that folks reading those plans may not immediately note as being impactful for telehealth?
Interesting. I don't think anything stuck out to me directly. I mean, the main focus was 100 million vaccinated in 100 days. That's awesome. Let's get that done, because then schools can open, meaning that they're, you know, parents of children who are single parents or who just have, you know, multiple jobs to make ends meet can then get in to see their providers for their health problems as well. And kids can access these school-based programs, which many of which, so you may or may not know that many kids access their health care through schools, through school nurses, school-based health programs. Schools have been closed. Those children are not accessing those programs. Telehealth did not rapidly expand into school-based health as quickly as to the rest of the market. Let's get those kids back into those programs, but let's also design programs for those children so that the next time we have an event like this where we have to go remote, we can also support their healthcare in the ways that we did before. And that's a very unusual gap, that we became dependent on some of these school-delivered health programs, but we're not able to just quickly ramp them up to the virtual world in the same way that we could with class.
Definitely, that's a great point. And, you know, speaking of that vaccine rollout, I've been struck over the last few weeks about the potential to use some of this remote patient monitoring technology and patient engagement technology that providers have been using for their sort of 360 virtual care strategies that might be used for vaccine rollout. And at the moment, they're not really. I don't know about you, but I've been seeing reports about the piece of paper that people get issued when they get a vaccine and thinking, oh my God, it's 2021. I have access to my bank account on my phone, and yet we're not using this technology. So is there anything about the vaccine rollout that you think legislators or health departments could use strategies learned from the telehealth advancement and to make that care more seamless on the COVID-19 vaccine rollout angle?
Yeah, so I think that you're bringing up very important considerations for public health in general. So when public health, our vast network of public health departments, their mission is to ensure the public health and safety when it comes to, in particular, communicable diseases. COVID-19 is obviously one of them. These vaccines, as they have been brought to market, some of them require two doses. There's a reason why they require two doses. There's reason to believe the first dose is helpful, but there's also reason to believe that second dose is needed. This is a medication adherence problem. We must not only ensure that everybody who can get vaccinated does get vaccinated, but that they also get that second dose. And I think that it will be more, require a little bit more than having a digital passport that you were vaccinated. That's an obvious solution. Yes, we can, like we have a boarding pass, get a picture of that CDC issued vaccination certificate. It's gonna require a lot more to make sure that people take dose number two. And it's also from the public health perspective, contact tracing and, tracking of where this disease stands. This is going to continue for a long time. How will public health officials understand which zip code has which vaccination rates so that they can target their resources and be effective? I hope that the Biden administration will provide unified communications that apply to all public health so that not every single public health department in the nation, because there are several thousand of them, is crafting their own policy for that.
It's kind of what we're seeing right now.
Yes, it is. And it actually, in my perspective, I think one of the greatest problems we've had this year has just been lack of unified message, lack of the most basic public health strategies being communicated in ways that are consistent and apolitical.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to think about the ways that, again, some of these techniques that I think people like the folks at Emoca and other vendors and telehealth providers have perfected over the years in terms of that medication adherence. I love thinking of the vaccine dose number two as a medication adherence issue. That's something I hadn't really considered, but I think it's really smart. And so it's really fascinating to me to think about the ways that we could use some of those medication adherence techniques, especially with chronic care, whether it's checking in on patients, whether it's smart devices that tell patients when they've taken their pills. I've seen some of those specifically with regard to birth control, some of those kinds of smart devices too. So obviously, we're not going to see those smart devices with vaccine adherence, but it is interesting to think about the ways that bringing medication into the home and out of the clinic and out of the doctor's office is going to be a continued trend throughout 2021.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So, you know, that when we want to solve a problem in the healthcare system, it gets done. So, for example, tuberculosis was a deadly disease and a huge concern in the United States in the 50s and the 60s. And by the late 1970s, a technique was developed that was enforced and driven through, and it's called directly observed therapy. So when a healthcare worker visits the patient, there is some controversy about the paternalistic aspects of that. But fact of the matter is, we went from like 35, 40,000 cases in the 70s down to about 9,000 last year. So we essentially made this disease much less relevant. Kids in schools who end up in the emergency room because they have asthma, in a city like Baltimore, you're going to get in certain neighborhoods 30% asthma among kids. There are directly observed therapy programs where you watch the child use their inhaler, coach them on how to do it. And these are all, like you just said, the taking of medication will be something that we have to monitor in the home if we want a result. We spend a lot of money on medication. And I'll tell you, what do you think happens in the hospital when you get medication? A nurse will come to you for every single patient. Every single dose in the United States of America given in a clinic will be observed, every single one. And then they will monitor what's your blood pressure? How is your, how's your heart rate? All these things will be monitored in person. Once the patient leaves that setting, that's all gone. None of that exists, and we have no information. So there's a huge opportunity to change a lot of that dynamic by taking the processes that we've already used for many, many years and bringing them to the home setting.
Well, this is a great conversation, and I almost hate to interrupt it, but we do probably need to draw it to a close. Kat, do you have a final question or two for Sebastian?
I have a very specific and wonky question to kind of wrap us up. And we're seeing bipartisan support for a lot of advancements in telehealth. Last year in Congress, there were a number of bills that got floated, none of which actually made it into law, but we saw some patterns with that. We saw the geographic and originating site requirements being lifted. That was a really popular one. There are questions around interstate licensing requirements, which continue to sort of muddy the waters. There are questions about reimbursement, which we've gone over. If you had to pick one for the next Congress to really advance of those sort of specific categories of telehealth legislation, which one would you pick?
Interesting. I'd pick two. One's on the docket and one's not. The first is this difference in interstate licensing is a complete disaster. Telling me that some patient that barely accesses care in California can't be helped by someone in Iowa. I mean, please, like we are, some of these patients are in dire straits and they could use any help that we can organize as a country. And I am all for states deciding on their own laws and their own policies, but this is a barrier to entry and a barrier to access for patients everywhere. That's the first. And the second is we have to stop fooling ourselves with probably the most radical healthcare change in the last 50 years are these amazing medications and therapies. Billions and billions of taxpayer dollars, trillions, went into creating them. And many times they are not taken properly. And we define adherence at CMS for HEDIS measures, STAR measures, as the refill rate. We should define adherence as the proportion of medications that were taken properly. And when we force the health system to reckon with that true definition, you will see that these medications actually can drive great health outcomes when they're actually taken by patients who need them. That would be my second answer. Had to get it in.
It's so interesting how all of the challenges in healthcare that we have been talking about and writing about for years, almost every single one of them has taken on sort of new importance and urgency in the light of a pandemic. And I think about medication adherence as this, I can't remember, there's a dollar figure that's always attached to it.
$350 billion.
$350 billion. Thank you. Yeah. And right. That we've been talking about just for years, and yeah, one hopes that it will be among the things that this pandemic encourages us to finally reckon with and get right. Well, thank you so much, Sebastian. Thank you, Kat. This has been a really great conversation. Certainly, I think it's going to be a big year in health tech and healthcare, and a lot to look forward to. I want to thank Khajiit for making this podcast possible. Khajiit is the only managed IoT connectivity services provider in the industry to offer a scalable IoT management platform, Sentinel, that includes complete visibility into real-time data usage, policy control management, custom content filters for added security, and multi-network flexibility. Khajiit is your trusted partner to enable your healthcare IoT solutions. You can find more at get.khajiit.net/healthIoT. Any final thoughts from either of you before we wrap up?
Thank you all very much. And Kat and Jonah, and keep optimistic. We'll get those vaccines out soon and get back to business as some kind of usual soon.
All right. Thanks so much. And of course, thank you all for listening. As always, we'll have links in the show notes to some of the things that we've talked about, some articles that Kat and her colleagues have written on these topics. And as always, you know, if you haven't yet, please do like the podcast, subscribe to the podcast, rate it, tell your friends. We're really trying to grow this year. And if you like what you're hearing, we really appreciate any support you can give us. Until next time, stay healthy, stay safe.